Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Alex Kaczynski, and I'm a judge on the Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit. Now, it turns out the life of a circuit judge can sometimes be a little mundane, so I always look for strange and exotic stories to spruce up my day. One of my law clerks recently came up with such a story, and this is, in fact, a true story, and it happens to involve constitutional law. It seems that my clerk had a friend back at school. I'm not allowed to mention the school except to tell you it's a well-known Eastern law school whose name vaguely rhymes with wayward. Anyway, this friend, I'll call him Bob, was an honor student and editor of the Law Review and had the usual panoply of honors and accolades. But he had one tragic flaw. When it came to a legal issue where he had strong policy views, he became extremely result-oriented. He just couldn't use his normal skills of legal reasoning. Nevertheless, he knew that success in the law meant appealing to accepted norms of legal thought, and so he looked for ways to reconcile his political agenda with the text and history of the Constitution. Now, if there was one thing that Bob hated more than anything else, it was the takings clause of the Fifth Amendment. Private property, these two words set his blood boiling. Now, he now had to destroy this anachronism once and for all, but he just couldn't find a way to do it. One day he was about to give up, he finally came up with a burst of inspiration. He had the solution and to rid the Constitution of this useless bit of Lockean baggage. And this consists of three separate theories that would show that the Constitution, interpreted according to its original intent, does not require protection of private property. Now, Bob's first posited what he called his theory of chronology. He pointed out that the Constitution protects life, liberty, and property in that exact order. The framers weren't dumb, Bob reasoned. Obviously, they knew that the most important things were mentioned first. Bob therefore surmised that the framers of the Fifth Amendment listed these three things, life, liberty, and property, in that particular order on purpose. Property was listed at all only to show that it was last and therefore least important. He had a second theory, and he called this the capitalization theory. He looked carefully at the Constitution and noticed a little known but important historical fact. In the original Constitution, the L's in life and liberty were capitalized, while the P in property was lowercase. Now, the framers of that Constitution were men of letters. Had they wanted to place property on the same high pedestal as life and liberty, they would have taken the important first step. They would have capitalized the P. This could not have been mere oversight. Obviously, the P was left uncapitalized simply to show the framers' contempt for the concept of property. And the finally, Bob came up with his most important and powerful theory of all. He called this the penmanship theory. Intent of researching the history of the Constitution, he traveled to the archives in Washington, D.C., and gazed upon the original document and discovered an important fact. The original Constitution turns out to be quite sloppy, and the ink wasn't then what it's today, and penmanship wasn't quite what it is one would desire. And when he looked carefully at the famous phrase from the Fifth Amendment, he noticed that the word property was hopelessly smudged. He was left confused, therefore, as to what could it have meant. Naturally, he concluded it could have meant anything at all. It could have meant life, liberty, and poverty. Crazy, maybe, but after all, America is a land of opportunity, and who can most benefit from opportunity than those who are poor? Or it could have read life, liberty, and profligacy. America is a land of riches, and perhaps the framers wanted to codify the tradition of excess in the Fifth Amendment. Or, maybe the framers gave in to a particularly effective lobby and on a single issue constituency and guaranteed the right to life, liberty, and piracy. He spun out dozens of such theories, and deciding that the word could mean anything at all, it meant nothing. Now, armed with these deep insights, and again, this is a true story, this future constitutional scholar set out to give original meaning back to the Takings Clause, and he's well on his way. He just not long ago finished a clerkship with one of my colleagues and is now teaching at West Coast Law School, whose name I'm also not allowed to mention, except to tell you that it rhymes with bumblebee. Now, despite Bob's skepticism, we know that the property was in fact something that was considered important by the founding fathers. It's certainly an important aspect of personal autonomy in our capitalistic society, and probably, I would guess, in any society involving human beings as we know them. But what is property? That's not an easy question to answer. I remember sitting in my first year property course, and on the very first day of class, and the professor, who by the way is Jim Creer, who you will see appearing on the program tomorrow, who teaches at Michigan now, the professor asked the fundamental question, what are property rights? I was excited. I had just spent 4 years as an economics major at UCLA, the University of Chicago at Los Angeles. And no one, but no one in the class knew more about property than I. So I threw up my hand and without even, just practically leapt out of my seat and without waiting for the professor to call on me, I said, property rights define the relationship between people and their property. Jim Creer wheeled around and he gave me a long look and finally he said, that's peculiar, Mr. Kaczynski. Have you always had relations with inanimate objects? Most people I know have relations with other people. Now, that wasn't the last time I said something dumb in class. But the lesson was not lost on me. Property rights are, of course, a species of relationships between people. At the minimum, they define the degree to which individuals may exclude other individuals from the use and enjoyment of goods and services. But we've seen property goes well beyond things physical. It includes rights to intangibles like patents and trademarks and copyrights. It may also include the rights to certain types of governmental benefits or to part of one's body or to one's reputation. All matters we will explore during the course of the symposium. Tonight we explore a particularly interesting aspect of property, those rights that are created through our tort liability system. Once the court enters a judgment in a tort case, the judgment unquestionably has the attributes of property. But what point before judgment does the right become property? At what point before judgment does it become property? At the time the lawsuit is filed? At the time of injury? How about at some earlier point in time? Can or should people be able to alienate rights to damages before the injury has occurred? And what effect will different rules of law have on the efficient and equitable allocation of resources? Now, to debate these and related questions, we have two very distinguished panelists. Peter Huber started out his career as an engineer. He got a PhD in mechanical engineering from MIT in 1976, and then taught mechanical engineering there, rising to the rank of associate professor. While still teaching at MIT, Dr. Huber attended Harvard Law School, where he graduated in 1982 summa cum laude, a very rare accomplishment indeed. After law school, he clerked for Circuit Judge Ruth Bader Ginsburg on the DC Circuit, and then for Justice Sandra Day O'Connor. In 1985, Dr. Huber served as a consultant to the Antitrust Division of the Department of Justice, where he prepared a report on competition in the telephone industry. He has written a number of other reports and articles, both for professional and popular journals. Most recently, he published his first book entitled Liability, The Legal Revolution and Its Consequences. He's now working on a second book on deregulation in the telecommunications industry under the auspices of the Manhattan Institute, where he's a senior fellow. Now, Dr. Huber will expound on some of the ideas in his book. Taking issue with Dr. Huber's position will be Professor Joseph A. Page from Georgetown University Law Center. Professor Page got all of his degrees from Harvard, an A.B. in classics in 1955, and an L.L.B. in 1958, and then an L.L.M. in 1964. He started his teaching career in 1964 at the University of Denver College of Law. He has been at Georgetown since 1968, where he teaches torts, products liability, food and drug law, lawyering in the public interest, government regulation of hazardous waste products, to name only a few of the subjects. He's a freelance journalist, a director of Public Citizen, and a public interest advocate himself. Now, Professor Page has written numerous articles on products liability and is author of a handbook on the law of premises liability. In 1973, he co-authored Bitter Wages, the Nader Report on Death and Injury on the Job. Now, Professor Page has also written extensively on non-legal subjects, particularly concerning South America. He has written a book entitled The Revolution That Never Was, Northeast Brazil, 1955 to 1964, and a biography of Juan Perón. He is currently under contract with Random House to write a book entitled The Brazilians. His wife, Martha Hill Monteiro, did I get it right? Yeah. Martha Hill Monteiro is the author of a soon-to-be-released book titled The Brazilian Bombshell, a biography of Carmen Miranda, which leads me to disclose that Professor Page is a director of the Carmen Miranda Samba School in Washington, D.C., which means that he and his wife and friends dress up in samba costumes and dance a samba in the Washington, D.C. Cherry Blossom Parade. And any of you who doubt this may watch Professor Sambo. Professor Page do the samba at this year's parade to be held April 8th to 9th. Now, the agreed upon format of the debate is as follows. Dr. Huber will have 12 minutes for an opening statement, and then Professor Page will also have 12 minutes. Each side will then get 3 minutes for rebuttal. By mutual agreement, all the time limits will be strictly enforced. After the statements and cross statements, we'll open the floor to questions. Dr. Huber.
Consider, ladies and gentlemen, the Danone cherry yogurt. Caution, it says on the top, these are real cherries, watch for pits. I have a slightly more elaborate example of the Danone cherry yogurt, or at least its wrapping. This is the package insert you get today with every dose of oral contraceptives. It runs, I'd say, 15 or 20 pages in normal type. This is the warning of the risks that come with this product. The typical product liability law review article these days reads much like this document. Indeed, significant parts of this document are lifted verbatim from state court opinions in litigation involving Ortho Pharmaceuticals product. And of course, the typical product liability law review article is about as informative as this document and about as useful. And now, one might think at the very least that this profusion of words on this paper or the simpler and, in fact, much more useful message on the Danone yogurt creates something in the nature of contract. It is a warning. It seems to be intended to communicate something from buyer to seller. You are, of course, free not to buy the product. One might think that if you did, you took it with knowledge of these things, with an understanding, with a tacit acceptance of the risk, and were therefore somehow falling under the laws of contract. It is alarming and important. Indeed, it is, I think, the only really important thing about modern product liability law, that this does not create contract. Indeed, contract has been completely and entirely and emphatically repudiated, and that is the starting point and ultimately the ending point of modern product liability law. We may start with the fairly obvious. Everything in this world contains pits of one kind or another. Knives, lawnmowers, and coleslaw machines, of course, cut not only cabbages, but also the king's or the king's fingers and hands and limbs. Pesticides and cancer therapies are designed to kill cells, and sometimes they kill the wrong kinds of cells. Ladders and planes raise people to heights, and sometimes they come down faster than they might wish to. And the question is, in the end, who owns the pit? Who has control over it? Who, in short, has responsibility for its tooth-shattering properties? Until the last few decades, really until the late 1950s, in my view, this was largely, not exclusively, but largely a matter of property and contract. You and the Danone Yogurt Company could answer these important questions by mutual agreement. Fraud and non-disclosure and such were, of course, separate matters. But if there was advanced disclosure, full warning, and so on, that was pretty much dispositive. The sales contract might include warranties, explicit or implied by the course of dealing, promises of safety and this sort of thing. And of course, these promises would be enforced, or these same promises might be disclaimed expressly or implicitly, and the disclaimers would then be enforced. One way or another, buyer and seller individually, privately, had the power to decide between themselves who owned the cherry, who owned the pit, who was responsible for which. Modern product liability law, as I say, the foundation, the cornerstone of modern product liability law is to reject that simple notion. The law, simply stated, no longer allows individual buyer and individual seller to deal and to set out the terms of safety exclusively on their own for themselves before the accident. Express contractual terms that address risks are rejected by the courts on theories that they reflect contracts of adhesion, unequal bargaining power, imbalanced information, or something of that sort. This means, of course, that if one wants to shoehorn everything into the property title of this conference, this means, in a manner of speaking, that seller and buyer today must hold the yogurt, the lawnmower, the airplane, the IUD, as a tenant in the entirety. Responsibilities, of course, are correspondingly blurred. You may think you bought the yogurt and it's your yogurt, but as soon as you break your teeth, you will remember that it is still partly owned by Dannon, and you will, and if you are the average consumer, proceed to court and remind Dannon of its joint tenancy and suggest that it should contribute to the upkeep and maintenance of the property and your dental bills. You may sue Dannon, you may lose, you may win. I would guess in most instances today you will lose. But the interesting point is that you won't lose automatically and definitely and emphatically because you had a contract and you were warned. If you win, or if Dannon wins that lawsuit, it will be because a jury has independently assessed the matters, worked out what it thinks are the fair terms of a contract in these circumstances, conducted some kind of risk-utility balancing that has no reference whatsoever to your express preferences, to the stated terms, the apparently stated terms of your contract, but rather is based on some utilitarian calculus conducted by others on their own initiative. Tort scholars hate to use the word contract. It has been essentially banished from the lexicon. They talk instead of something called consumer contemplation. The big debate in the 1970s in tort law was how to define product defects. It turns out to be a much more elusive and complicated question than one might think. And for a while, it looked like we would define the product defect, which is all important in modern product liability law, by asking what did this consumer or what did the average consumer contemplate, what did he expect to get, what did she think she was taking on when she bought the yogurt or the contraceptive or what have you, and this would define whether the product was defective or not. That notion was resoundingly and emphatically rejected. If you don't get what you expect, you can sue. Consumer contemplation counts when it is not realized, not satisfied, but if you do get exactly what you expected to get, exactly what you were promised, there is an independent calculation, a second test, which is somehow whether the product meets somebody else's tests of defectiveness, of propriety, of suitability. Many consumers, of course, are inclined to think this is a good thing. After all, if you get the Dannon yogurt without the pits, as they say in New York, enjoy. If you get the Dannon yogurt with the pits, as they tell you in law school, sue. If you break a tooth, you have a remedy. If you don't break a tooth, you have a yogurt. What could be more congenial? To coin a phrase, of course, there is no such thing as a free dentist. At the very least, you pay dearly for this right, much more dearly than most people realize. If you buy a football helmet today, it's $100 on a $200 helmet. That inalienable right to sue is costing you 50% of the cost of the helmet. That same inalienable right to sue is costing you $11.50 on a $12 dose of childhood vaccine, $20,000 on a $60,000 small plane, $20 on a $100 stepladder, and so on. More than 50 cents on the dollar is never coming back to any consumer. It's going into the hands of the intermediaries, the lawyers, the insurance companies, the expert witnesses, the courts, and so on and so forth. But money, of course, is not the only thing you pay for this non-negotiable right to sue product manufacturers. When government, through its courts, takes over the business of writing contracts and setting out the terms of bargain and sale, things go wrong sooner or later, most especially when these terms aren't going to be settled until years after the sale, and then only through a rather erratic and highly unpredictable process. In the worst cases, the terms become entirely prohibitive. The absence of certainty shuts down markets today altogether. As a consumer in America today, you cannot buy a vaccine from 10 of the 12 manufacturers that were doing active research and development on vaccines in the mid-1960s. Those 10 have wisely, and in my view, quite rationally decided that operating within the current product liability climate is simply out of the question. For similar reasons, you can no longer buy a piston engine plane from Cessna. We have just about shut down our small plane industry, notwithstanding the furious objections of private pilots, consumers, like me, because the industry simply cannot deal with the uncertainties of ex post determination of the terms of purchase and sale. No doubt we are all glad that we can no longer buy a Dalcon Shield from A.H. Robbins, but the same system that assured us of that has also assured us that we can no longer buy a Lippi's Loop or a Copper 7 IUD from Searle or Johnson & Johnson. And for a significant class of patients, those would be superior contraceptive options, indeed the best, most reliable options as well. If you manufacture brake linings and gaskets and seals today, you are still using, this surprises most people, but you are still using asbestos. You cannot buy the principal substitute, calcium sodium metaphosphate, from Monsanto, because Monsanto realizes, quite correctly in my view, that you have to be a lunatic to think of introducing a substitute for asbestos in today's product liability system, where you cannot have any assurance of on what terms you are going to sell that product on. Of course, if you just wake up one morning and discover you've entered a stupid contract, it is a great relief to learn that the law of contract has been abolished, at least insofar as your particular error was concerned. If you've just been stopped for speeding, I suppose you would also be happy to learn that the speeding laws had just been abolished. But consumers, as a group, do not benefit from this kind of change. In the end, contract is the right that supports all others, most especially in a technological society that relies, as ours does, on highly diversified, specialized production. It is through voluntary agreement, through contract, that we control our own bodies by choosing medical services and contraceptives and cigarettes and alcohol. It is through willing contract that we control our movements by purchasing automobiles or airline tickets. It is through contract, again, that we control our social universe by taking part in clubs and voluntary associations of all kind. To the extent we undercut contract, as modern product liability law does relentlessly and deliberately, we undercut all of these other rights as well. For purposes of provocation, I shall end with the right of abortion, said, of course, by some, though not by others, to be guaranteed by the Constitution itself. Whatever the Constitution may say, if it is to mean anything more than a coat hanger or a back alley butchery, the right of abortion obviously depends on the right to get help from others in the mainstream economy. French women today can buy a product called RU486, which is a chemical abortifacient. You take a pill, you get an abortion. By all accounts, it is cheaper, less traumatizing, safer than going under the knife. It is quite inconceivable that any major diversified pharmaceutical company will sell it in the United States. The principal problem is not opposition from the religious right. That could be overcome. The profit incentive would overcome that. The principal problem is that no sane company will sell any product of this type, because the risks of the finding out 5 years down the line what the real terms of the sale were are simply too great. Of course, we would all like to have more of the cherry and less of the pit. We would all like to fly without taking the risk of falling. We would all like to seek love without courting the danger of rejection. But the real world simply doesn't allow such things. And when our courts try to pretend otherwise, we all end up worse off. The question in the end is, comes down to this in product liability law. Who owns the cherry? Who owns the pit? Who's responsible for protecting your teeth while you feed your face? If you're the same age as my daughter, Sophie, who is 9 months old now, the answer is simple. She's not responsible. Someone else must be. The law has always deprived children of the power to bind themselves fully in contracts, and I suppose that's the way it should be. What is uniquely different about our modern product liability law is that it has chosen to extend that same special treatment to all adults. Courts and juries, the law assumes, must operate for the consumer in loco parentis now and forevermore. And this attitude, in the end, does not promote safety any more than it promotes convenience or affluence or efficiency. In fact, it robs us ultimately of our most basic economic freedom, which is the freedom to plan in advance, to make commitments, to arrange deals on terms agreeable not just to one side, but to both sides. If the consumer can freely insist on the rights of a child after the accident, he or she will very quickly come to be treated as a child before the accident as well. And that is not a positive or a useful world to live in. Thank you very much.
I'd like, first of all, to thank Judge Kaczynski for that wonderful introduction. I don't know whether I ought to sing and dance or whether I ought to go on with this prepared remarks. It was a wonderful introduction. It was much better than one I got a couple of months ago when somebody introduced me by saying, due to the high cost of Ralph Nader, we have with us today. I didn't realize that Dr. Huber was going to bring his warning label from the oral for the contraceptives. If I'd known that, I would have brought my audio tape from the Bryn Ward where victims of pinogas tank explosions were interned, and we could test levels of humor and indignation. The Dan and Yogurt case kind of puzzles me. I didn't think that was something that people got indignant about. I would suggest that probably Dan and Yogurt would settle that one without blinking twice, without getting into risk utility tests or anything else. Whenever there's a foreign substance in food that people don't normally expect and it causes harm, it's fairly open and shut case, unless, of course, there's a large warning label on the container that says "Watch out for pits in the cherries." Then maybe we have another ball game there. Now, Dr. Huber's thesis, as I understand it, is that the tort system currently delivers less safety than it might otherwise realize for two reasons. First, it discourages scientific and technological innovation, which in the long run would bring about a net increase in social benefit. And second, it either disregards or fails to take adequate account of safety trade-offs, whereby the imposition of liability for one type of conduct might deter that conduct, yet at the same time encourage alternative measures which may be even riskier or more detrimental to society as a whole. What I'd like to do is put forward a something of a critique of his case against the court system. With respect to the deterrence of safety innovation, the point I think needs to be stressed at the outset that the mere fact that a corporate official claims that a company isn't spending money on a particular product, such as contraceptives, for fear of lawsuits does not necessarily prove that tort suits are in fact responsible for discouraging the company from innovating. The assertion could be self-serving in the sense that it might promote a corporate interest in advocating changes in product liability law which would favor manufacturers. It might reflect an overreaction on the part of corporate decision makers. It might conceal other factors which might have influenced the decision. For example, in the eyes of a company, profits from the sale of a particular product might not be too high to justify research expenditures. Frankly, I can't take all that seriously, Dr. Huber's claim that the French abortion pill isn't going to come on the market here because of fear of product liability suits. It seems to me the quote, specter, unquote, of product liability would fade before the kind of retaliatory action anti-abortion groups in this country would threaten that company. It's already happening, as I believe it was a New York Times article indicated, it's already happening in France, and you can bet that what is happening there would happen 100 or 1,000-fold here. There is more research going on these days in the birth control industry, as a recent article in the New York Times indicated. Although research spending has been down, political and economic, as well as legal reasons, are cited as the cause. Moreover, worldwide spending on research is reported to have declined by nearly 25% in the past 15 years, a trend which can hardly be attributable to tort suits, at least with respect to foreign R&D. The article points out that substantial profits are being made by those companies which have remained in the field, and notes that several firms are working to bring new contraceptive products to the market, although a patent dispute between two of them is delaying the introduction of a new version of the pill. So one may justifiably entertain doubts about calls for radical change in the tort system when these calls are based upon assignments of the of blame which don't altogether stand up to close scrutiny. Let me cite another example, and this is an example that Dr. Huber didn't mention, but you'd find it in his book. He links the risk of tort liability with the unwillingness of physicians to play the good Samaritan and stop to aid accident victims who are strangers to them. Now, it is true that some years ago, physicians vigorously lobbied state legislatures to secure enactment of so-called good Samaritan statutes limiting the liability of healthcare professionals who stop to render aid to strangers. And proponents of these laws did, in fact, point to the existence of apprehension on the part of doctors that they might be sued if they volunteered to help accident victims. Yet, it is also true that at that particular time, there was no, I repeat, no record of any physician ever having been sued under those circumstances. Moreover, even after the enactment of Good Samaritan statutes, which considerably narrowed the grounds on which a doctor might be held liable, a poll of physicians revealed that more than half still would not provide medical assistance to a stranger. So an exaggerated perception of the tort system seems to have been no more than a fig leaf for other reasons why physicians refuse to help strangers in need of medical attention. One of a handful of products to which Dr. Huber points as victims of lawsuits which have produced, on balance, socially undesirable results is the IUD, or intrauterine device. He asserts that litigation took from the market not only the infamous Dalkin shield, which deserves its fate, and by the way, I assume that means that he thinks the tort system does some good, but also two other IUDs, which were the safest effective alternatives available to many women, and that because no alternatives to these devices are available, a number of unwanted pregnancies may occur. In addition, he has claimed that lawsuits have put upon IUD makers an excessive burden with respect to warnings which must accompany the product, and that this burden is a barrier to innovation. First of all, the other IUDs to which Dr. Huber refers could be used safely only by women who have already been, or who had already been pregnant and who had have stable sexual relationships. A large part of the liability problem stemmed from the fact that the manufacturer had been targeting a much larger and hence more profitable market. One interpretation of what happened is that instead of intelligently searching out the appropriate market and promoting and labeling the product accordingly, the manufacturer chose to cease production of IUDs. Thus, one might question, is it the tort system that caused this? With respect to the characterization of the duty to warn as being onerous to the point of discouraging innovation in the production of IUDs, this judgment is surely premature. The one company which remains in the field, ALZA, has in fact pioneered the development of an informed consent brochure which seeks to ensure that only those women for whom the device is appropriate will use it, and that any woman considering use of the product will be able to make an intelligent choice about her method of contraception. A second company which has entered the field has adopted the identical informed consent form for its IUD. It's probably not far-fetched to suggest that product liability suits brought against IUD makers and based upon a failure to warn theory may have contributed to the development of the ALZA informed consent brochure. Now, this is not the first time that the tort system has achieved salutary results. One can point to other examples of product liability litigation which have at least contributed to the removal of unsafe products from the market or to changes in design which have eliminated unreasonable dangers from a product. Among these are the Dalkin Shield IUD, which we've already mentioned, superabsorbent tampons, which cause toxic shock syndrome, tip-over hot water vaporizers, which were redesigned to be tip-proof after a series of lawsuits, the redesign of tire rims so that they no longer pose an unreasonable risk of exploding. By the way, I do not advance the claim that the tort suits were necessarily the sole trigger of these developments, but rather that they contribute in important ways. Now, I don't stand alone in my assertion that the tort system does some things right. A 1987 report by the Conference Board, the research arm of the business community, found that, quote, where product liability has had a notable impact, where it has most significantly affected management decision making, has been in the quality of the products themselves. Managers say products have been become safer, manufacturing procedures have been improved, and labels and use instructions have become more explicit. I should, of course, point out that those who fund the Conference Board were so displeased by this report that they killed a messenger who was responsible for the bad news. The author of the study was fired, a second report undertaken, and predictably more palatable findings were reached. The first report surveyed risk managers of major corporations, the hands-on managers who deal firsthand with such matters as product design, insurance costs, and actual exposure to litigation. The second report surveyed chief executive officers who were much more attuned to the debate than that was going on in Congress at the time over product liability reform. One of the crisis areas to which Dr. Huber points is the small plane industry, where liability insurance costs for manufacturers are said to be forcing such sharp price increases that it is no longer economical to produce them in the United States. I should add parenthetically, sharp price increases in liability insurance premiums do not necessarily reflect the influence of tort law. About 10 years ago, a small fish bait company in northern Michigan saw its liability increase between 4 and 5-fold, even though no product liability claim had ever been filed against it in its 50-odd years of existence. In any event, if I understand the problem correctly with respect to small planes, it affects only the sort of aircraft used by Sunday afternoon leisure pilots and not the market for small jet aircraft, probably because the corporate purchases of these latter planes do not mind and probably insist on installing the most effective and up-to-date safety features on planes designed to carry corporate executives. First of all, we need to know a lot more about the safety record of these aircraft. Are they falling all the time? Is that what the problem is? Are they falling because of manufacturing defects or design defects? How often do purchases of these planes bring product liability suits? How successful have they been? And interestingly, probably, how often have pilots injured in these crashes, yet concerned about the rising costs and concomitant unavailability of small recreation planes, have opted to forego bringing product liability suits and to rely upon their first-party insurance for compensation. Dr. Huber suggests that one solution for resolving the liability crisis is to promote greater reliance upon pre-accident contractual arrangements to settle the responsibilities of sellers. He criticizes the judicial trend to abrogate the defenses of express assumption of the risk in product liability cases, which he sees as a major obstacle to his proposed restructuring the liability system. The recreational aircraft area is one which would be amenable to private arrangements between sellers and knowledgeable purchasers who are aware of the risks, yet prefer to encounter them rather than foregoing recreational flying. In theory, I have no problem with this line of argument. I tend to agree with the proposition that courts have been quick and perhaps too quick to deny individuals the right to assume on a voluntary and fully informed basis risks of harm to themselves. Such agreements, of course, could not bind third parties. Hence, passengers in these small planes and persons not riding in the planes, on the ground, in other planes, and harmed by crashes caused by defects in the planes would still have the right to bring product liability suits. The question I pose is whether the relief manufacturers would receive from this rather limited use of contract via express assumption of risk would make a significant enough impact upon the problem. Just how many, within the broad context of the whole product liability problem, how many instances are there where a purchaser has full information of all the risks that which are involved and doesn't and can make a free and voluntary choice with respect to those dangers? If, for example, if a person can choose between a less expensive product without safety devices and a more expensive product with safety devices, and chooses the less safety, the less expensive product with fewer safety devices, then it seems to me clear in that situation, knowing what the risks are and specifically opting to encounter them, that person shouldn't be permitted to bring a suit subsequently based upon the absence of the safety feature which he decided to forego. But that's a problem, it seems to me, that the courts can very easily work out, can very easily fix. I don't think it's a problem that it's going to come up all that often. I do think that we can count upon the courts to render some sensible decisions in this area, but I don't think that that's going to really solve the problem as it is seen by the critics of the system. I guess that's my time.
I don't want to respond for 3 minutes. I'd like to make one very small point, but I can't resist, I'm afraid, and then one larger one. Professor Page may not be aware, but the small plane industry is self-insured. They run their own insurance company, so their increase in insurance rates is probably not a conspiracy or a collusion among other insurers, because they insure themselves. In fact, the record on payouts is very clear. Safety has steadily improved for 20 years. Lawsuits have steadily increased. There's a much larger point to discuss here. The first is this. The universe of accidents divides, roughly speaking, into two sections. One is the entirely non-consensual interference, the attack by a stranger, the trespass, the collision between strangers, and that's what people usually have in mind when they talk about torts. That is, in fact, it's a very important area, but it is the less important area in modern product liability and modern liability law generally. Most accidents arise, like most murders, arise in the context of acquaintance. They arise in the employment context, in the between doctor and patient, in the sale of products. And in this context, at least, there is theoretically a possibility of a contractual remedy instead of the tort remedy. The second point to understand, and this is very basic, but it seems to me that with an audience like this, in a forum like this, we should be talking about legal principles and doctrines. Modern product liability law is very explicit and just about uniform across the country. If the consumer does not get what the average consumer would contemplate in these cases, if in some gross sense there is a violation of contractual commitment, contractual promise, there is a clear right to recovery. Hardly anybody quarrels with that. And all of the theories of recovery based on non-disclosure, fraud, failure to warn of known risks all fit within that ambit, and there is rather little dispute about them. There is a second large and much more important body of modern tort law, and that says it doesn't matter what the consumer contemplated. It doesn't matter what the contract said. There will be an entirely separate second test for liability assessed by a jury, by a court, people who are not party to the original transaction, people who are spending somebody else's money, not their own, applying entirely extrinsic factors that depend not at all on express preferences, that are entirely independent of any contractual commitments or waivers or assumption of risk or otherwise, that are a sort of a third party, essentially a statist weighing of risks and utilities, and a third party assessment of what is right. That is the very, very poisonous and ultimately dangerous area of modern product liability law. It undercuts safety just as it undercuts convenience, just as it undercuts efficiency, for all of the reasons that, at least for an audience like this, are all too familiar. Contract is efficient. It lets people seek out better and worse options. Of course, people sometimes make stupid contracts. Freedom implies the possibility of exercising your freedom in foolish ways. But nonetheless, as a general principle, the freedom lets people arrange their own affairs, seek out their own preferences, and advance their own welfare.
I know that it's tempting to speak in terms of theory, but perhaps one also ought to pose the question as to how this thing is actually going to work in real life. That is to say, does this mean that every individual consumer going into the supermarket or the hardware store is going to negotiate a contract with the seller ahead of time with respect to the responsibilities of the seller and the rights of the consumer? Or does this mean that there's going to be some standard form, some take it or leave it document that the consumer must confront if he or she wants to buy that product? What I'm suggesting is that there are some transaction costs with this contract notion that perhaps ought to be ought to be explored. Secondly, with respect to the risk utility versus the consumer expectation test, I think it ought to be pointed out, first of all, that what we're talking about here is a partial area of product liability law. These tests do not apply in cases involving construction or manufacturing defects, cases of mismanufacture. Here, there's no dispute, or at least I think there's no dispute, that if the product is defective in this particular way, the manufacturer is going to be strictly liable and the manufacturer is going to pay out. The difficulty and the dispute arises in the area of allegedly defective design and allegedly inadequate warnings or instructions for use. And here we have several different trends, or it's several different approaches that are taken by courts. I think that what Dr. Huber seems to be doing is taking a decision from the California Supreme Court, which has been followed, I believe, only by a handful of jurisdictions, and applying that as the straw man here, the Barker case in California. But in fact, courts in design warning cases on the whole use what amounts to a negligence test. I would say the great majority of jurisdictions apply factors which are indistinguishable from factors in a negligence test. So there are other jurisdictions that apply a consumer expectation test, but my point is only that the panorama is a bit more complex than it's been made out to be.
We will take questions. Professor Krier?
Sure.
As Henry Kissinger once said, just call me Excellency. But
Professor, just pull the mic close to your mouth. That's good.
Okay. I have just a couple questions. What was that thing you called that?
This is the package insert.
What's the point of that?
It's a warning.
That's what you want, isn't it?
It runs around. I do want. I would have thought it had some kind of binding and final effect. It doesn't. You may still litigate with Ortho as to whether the estrogen level is a design defect. You may still litigate with them on the general concept of whether oral contraceptives belong in the spectrum at all, or whether we should all be eating strawberry yogurt.
Okay, but I got the sense from your description of it, you regard it as worthless anyway, as essentially unintelligible, unreadable. I thought your analogy was good, a classic law review article. I mean, why wouldn't your contract system devolve into that and people have extraordinary search costs? And given that they have to live with regret if they get socked by, and you know, I think the cherry pit story is convincing, but let's say a man-made cherry pit that has some evil thing in it, you know more about those things than I do, but they wouldn't buy the damn things at all. So there wouldn't be any market instead of the struggling one. That's one question I have. The other is that you talk about safety has been increasing for 20 years and liability too, like safety is driving the liability. It seems plausible to me that liability is driving the safety. And, you know, you're in a tough spot in a way because, I mean, there the system is, and you're going to have to come up with the case for overturning it. And I'm bothered by sort of the range of this, in particular, why you see the mechanism being in one direction when it's pretty plausible that it's the development of strict liability that drove the development of safety. Those are the questions I have.
The second one I find easier to answer. I'm afraid I will use a blackboard. If you plot out accident rates in small planes since they were invented somewhere around 1910 or something to 1990, and this has been done, incidentally. The line, this is the accident rate. It's absolutely smooth, uninterrupted. If you plot the rate of payouts in liability suits, it begins around 1965 and it's gone like that. So I don't think you'll have to have a pretty elaborate statistical program to find a causal a correlation there. in fact, of course, people have people have tried to look across the board at this. George Priest at Yale has done some studies. I will state, I think I can state with confidence, nobody has demonstrated an empirical correlation on either side, okay? Either showing that increased liability across the board has increased safety, or supporting my thesis, which is that generally this growth in the system has decreased the critical elements of progress and safety, which depend on innovation and aggressive technological development. We all rely on anecdotes on both sides. As to your first question, I'm afraid I kind of missed your question. I'm a believer in contract. This is, of course, not the contract the parties would write for themselves. This is a contract written largely by the courts under our bizarre, extremely stretched theories of warning law today. But I am a believer in contract. I would take even this abomination, since it was written by the courts, and say that's it, okay? But that is not the law today.
Okay. I mean, just to clarify, my point was that I'll come back to your answer to my second question tomorrow. Given the nature of a lot of modern risk, at least as I understand it, and you have a comparative advantage, so these contracts might seem easy to you, but not to the consumers of the technologies. And so the contractual, I mean, you can't just say IUD, warning, it might bend your baby. There's going to be a lot of complicated contractual provisions. And that means to me that search costs are going to be very high. There's going to be a lot of regret if I think that I am contracting out of things that I don't even understand. You sort of dismiss asymmetric information. I mean, why the hell do you go to engineering school if you don't believe in asymmetric information? Okay? That's what specialization is about. And so if I have a dread of regret, then I might drop out of the market altogether, and to exactly the point you say, that I'll actually increase the danger in my life, but I feel there's no other way out, okay? But with liability, I can take care of after the fact. I can take care of regret. It's an expensive way to take care of it, but it might be the only way to maintain the market. That was the question, or so to say.
I've learned to my chagrin that if you make appropriate assumptions about either transaction costs or imbalance information, you can justify any policy of any type for anything. There are no exceptions to that. And I must say, Judge Richard, should I name names? There is a prominent conservative judge who has largely embraced, used these tools to conclude that the modern liability system is indeed efficient. I am inclined to disagree with that. We will always have problems of imbalanced information and unequal bargaining power. I would have thought that if we are worried about the imbalanced information between pilots and plane manufacturers, we would rely on people who know more about the design of, say, fuel systems for planes, which are not jurors pulled off the street, but rather the Federal Aviation Administration, which makes calls between carburetors and fuel injectors, which the liability system insists upon making de novo again. Beyond that, we do end up with an act of faith. If you assume consumer incompetence, if your starting assumption is that the average consumer for most products today is really the equivalent of my 9-month-old daughter, which pretty much is the starting assumption of the modern liability system, you very quickly conclude that people other than the consumer have to run the world. I think that's a very dangerous starting point. It leads to all sorts of undesirable policy.
Just a closing. Just let me say one closing word, and then I will
shut up, except
for when I have the floor tomorrow. I don't know how you can say this about the FAA when you write stuff saying the agencies are as hard on risk as the courts.
Can we have the next question? If you want to ask a question, please.
With all due respect,
could you step to the microphone?
My time and 10 years of experience, and I can't buy a Cessna any more than anybody else in here with a lot less flying time. My question is both of you.
We're recording this. Could you step to the microphone?
My question to you is that you both have defined limits. Dr. Huber, you're probably familiar with the recent General Dynamics case where a widow and a country lawyer basically sued General Dynamics and the U.S. Air Force for lying about imperfect information, lying about what caused the crash and killed a man and probably killed several others as well. And the Supreme Court came out with the famous government contractor defense as a result. That was an example of imperfect information. I've already defined the example of your view, Professor Page, with respect to even somebody with tremendous experience. I still can't buy a Cessna. Is there a middle ground? I'm having a problem defining. Your view is that the tort system, current tort system, is fine and we shouldn't touch it. And is your view, Dr. Huber, that the tort system is not fine? And as one of my famous tort professors used to say, by the name of, it rhymes with Borowitz, used to say that we need to totally trash it and start over again. I'm having a problem defining exactly what your views are, because contractually there's a problem with imperfect information, as just defined, and the tort system obviously has a problem too currently.
Well, let me respond first to say that I don't believe that the tort system is perfect. There are many ways in which the changes can be made in to improve the tort system. I've already mentioned one way. There is a tremendous problem of wasted resources in the system, where too few dollars get to accident victims and too many dollars are swallowed up in administrative costs. There are doctrines within the tort system or doctrines which have been adopted by some courts, for example, with respect to the introduction of evidence of post-accident changes, which may have a deleterious effect on safety if they persuade corporate counsel to advise their clients not to recall a dangerous and defective product on the grounds that it might amount to an admission of liability. So there are many problems with the tort system. My position is merely that I don't see that the case has been made for jettisoning it and starting with something else. I don't see the something else, first of all, that's worth replacing it with, and secondly, I don't see a something else which could replace it in the light of political reality.
Well, political realities are one thing, but they're too discouraging to dwell on. The fact is, if you'd like to see models of other systems, I can suggest two places to look. One is everywhere in the world except the United States, all right? And the other is the United States before 1960, all right? And that's really quite a large universe of possibilities. There is, of course, a third universe, how we could return to notions of contract with a more generous face, and I discuss some of those in my book. There are other options. In answer to the gentleman's question, there is a core choice you make at the outset. You know, do you place your basic faith in private autonomy, individual power, and the law of contract, or do you place your ex ante decisions on risk and safety and product design and so on, or do you place your basic faith in third-party decisions in courts ex post? With the people who are making the decisions, not spending their own money, not sort of directly involved in the marketplace themselves. This does, I suppose, come down ultimately to a matter of faith, but I would have thought for a conservative audience, for libertarians, it is a fairly easy call to make at the outset. And what astounds me, what truly astounds me, is that there is such a large body of legal scholarship coming supposedly from the law and economics conservative movement that seems to support this extremely misguided liability system we're trying to run today.
Back to the professor's phone.
I have a feeling that I'm listening to a debate on the wrong subject. First of all, I want to say I have never seen this man in my life. I didn't put him up to say what he said. But shouldn't we perhaps search for a middle ground? And here is a modest suggestion. Given some of the true, what I call, I too have a degree in engineering, Mr. Huber. Given true defective designs that are with us, that people are often unable, or indeed the engineers are unable to discern until after the product is in use for a while. And given the difficulties of proof and so on and so on, maybe product liability isn't such a bad thing, Professor Page. But before you smile too broadly, it seems to me that our problem is not that these things happen, but rather the degree to what they happen. And how about working on the slope of that curve rather than on abolishing the system? In other words, what do you gentlemen think of this irreverent theory that it is really the judges who have screwed up by not suitably riding herd on the quantum of damages which is recovered in these cases, and have not protected us from the seven-figure verdicts which keep dropping, oh yes, yes indeed, with some regularity, and encourage more litigation and so on. How about working on the rate of recovery rather than on liability? What do you think?
Well, if I could comment first, I'm not sure I agree, because I haven't seen any evidence to suggest that people who recover seven-figure verdicts haven't lost seven figures, haven't suffered seven figures worth of loss. The reason that we have now proliferation of seven-figure verdicts is because medical costs are tremendously high. It's because modern technology has reached a point where people who would have died in accidents a few years ago now get to live out a life expectancy as vegetables or as very seriously injured people. And
well, let's talk about non-economic damages.
I
understand your point.
Yeah.
But what about non-economic damages, or the often too ready granting of punitive damages in very dubious circumstances?
Well, that's something that with respect to the latter, that's something that I think the judges can address. They certainly have the tools to address it, and perhaps.
How about the collateral rule, collateral source rule? Can you do something about that?
I'm not sure that the judges can fix that. I think that would have to be addressed legislatively.
Well, I didn't say the judges should fix that. I said judges have screwed. Well, I'm a Californian, as you can surmise, and I remember Roger Treanor, the young one, who argued for expanded liability, and all these young people have been taught this, but very few of us remember Roger Treanor the old, when he was a dissenter again, saying, wait a minute, we may be going too far. It is a responsibility of the courts to limit, to control the quantum of damages, and not simply say it's all up to the jury and walk away. Well, he never succeeded in persuading his colleagues on that one, did he?
Well, I'm happy to hear that there was a Roger Treanor the Elder.
If
you've read Dr. Huber's book, he castigates Judge Treanor the Younger without mentioning.
That is quite false. In my book, I can point you to chapter and verse where I quote Roger Treanor the Elder to exactly that effect, that he was appalled to see what his system had done. You will find it in my book.
We started a little bit late. We'll go another 5 minutes. Yes, sir. Okay. Could you state your name? I didn't ask those before, but just for the record.
My name's Joe Cosby. I'm almost tempted to ask why you think that healthcare costs are so high in an era of seven-figure malpractice claims, but I'll leave that for someone else. And I'm going to focus on something, Professor Page, that you mentioned in your opening statements. You said that it was all right with you if someone had a choice between a product designed without a particular safety feature and a product designed, you know, in a lower cost, and a product designed with that safety feature and the higher cost, because obviously in that case, the person has the free choice and the ability. However, it strikes me that is exactly the case that is the biggest loser under the design theory of product liability, that if you went out and knowingly designed your product with a safety feature that you could have built in, that other people were building into their product, that you've got a design defect in most cases. And I'm wondering if, how do you reconcile that with
The point I'm making is that there are two different, there's a range of products from which a person has to choose. Put it most simply, you can buy a VW Beetle or you can buy a Cadillac if you're worried about crashworthiness on the highway. Obviously, you're going to be a lot safer in the Cadillac. You know that you buy one of these little Chinese lantern cars. that it's not going to give you the same kind of protection, but you want to pay less. You don't want the kinds of features.
What if you buy a lawnmower without a safety catch as opposed to a lawnmower that's got one and that's on the market?
Well, what I'm suggesting is that if you do this with full knowledge of the risk and you say, yeah, I want that one because I want to pay less.
Are you going to determine that before they buy it or afterwards?
Oh, before.
Okay. One more quick question.
All right. We'll end.
I'll try to make it quick. I think I gave away the game, Professor Page. I mean, clearly your perspective is safety at all costs, even at the cost of progress. And you're comfortable with a tort system, which you very mildly say there are some imperfections, but don't those imperfections have some very serious problems in them? When you talk about a tort system, which is, could you please address these issues, gone from one of a fault system to actually a true, an absolute compensation system. In response to the last question, the question is no longer any more fault, even in the terms of strict liability theory, but what indeed are the extent of damages to someone's injury in having contact with the product. And isn't your system much more corrupt when you look at, you have an expert witness for hire system, which just, you know, every, you know, rational person can perceive, but is insulated within the courtroom context. You have judge-made law, which is totally unpredictable to the manufacturing class out there. They have no idea where this is going to go, where the limits are going to be, such, you know, strange theories as market share liability. Even if you made that kind of product, you may have to share in the damages there. Could you address those, what you call mild imperfections, which really plague this system and really create these now eight-figure verdicts, as the ABA Journal is laid out?
Well, let's see if I can remember all these different points here. One is that I would dispute the view that the tort liability system has completely done away with negligence and that we now have a strict liability system whereby the only issue that now must be confronted is the extent of damages. I just think that's not that's not true, flat out. With respect
to
them,
I say you'd lose your appeal on that. A strict liability system excludes negligence. There's no negligence here in a strict product liability system.
Well, are you talking about the problem that I have with you is you're jumping back and forth. Are you talking about the tort
cases? All these cases.
Are you talking tort or are you talking tort or product liability?
It's one and the same.
Well, when you say tort, I'm thinking of premises liability. I'm thinking of medical
liability. Yes.
You're talking about product liability. Well, my point is that in many jurisdictions, in design cases and warnings cases, you can't recover unless you can make out the elements of a negligence case. I think that's fairly well settled. The only area that we have true pure strict liability is the area of product defects, manufacturing or construction defects. With respect to market share theory. What's the alternative there? We have a situation now where manufacturers make generic products which can't be identified. If that's the case, then they'll never be impossible to hold them liable for the harm that their products might cause if they turn out to be defective. Now, the various theories, market share and other, which the courts have been struggling to develop, do have as one result the fact that they are going to encourage these manufacturers in the future to manufacture, to keep proper records, to manufacture products which can be identified. If you don't have some kind of an incentive for this, you're going to end up with absolutely no deterrence to the marketing of unsafe, generic, unidentifiable or products that are completely alike that can't be identified.
Before we close, I've been asked to make an announcement. There'll be a hospitality suite immediately following the debate on the terrace of the first floor of the Michigan Union. I'm told that's across State Street and to the right. I want to thank Dr. Huber, Professor Page,